supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Like a interactive art installation. Instead of just putting it all in a bunch of cases that are very linear and sterile, where you kind of stare at it and say, oh, there's a thing, and walk away. This is like, ooh, what's this little thing? Whoa, you know, there's a pizza face.
Dwyer says he's surprised a pizza museum doesn't already exist. I'm Elizabeth Fiedler, WHYY News.
In sports, Giants with a 7-2 win over the Phils last night. Game 2 is at 4:05 today, and the Union head north to Red Bull Stadium. Game time, 2:30. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of those jam-packed shows for you today, cats and kittens. When we get to the question of the week, we'll tell you how to defeat the iris borer, that hungry, hungry caterpillar that bores into those pretty flowers and destroys them. We'll also talk to our old friend, Dr. Bill Quarles, about the current plight of honeybee colonies in America. And that's a lot to do, so we better jump right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Bob. Where are you, sir?
In Kimberton, Pennsylvania.
Kimberton, a hotbed of organic and biodynamic gardening activities.
Exactly.
All right. What can we do for Bob in Kimberton, Pennsylvania?
We've got a real problem with whitefly. They are just taking over our flower beds. They haven't gone into our vegetable garden.
Well, that's good.
We are completely organic, so I just don't, other than insecticidal soap, I don't know what to do about them and how to get rid of them.
Insecticidal soap, you know, appears to be like the number one answer on the minds of all organic gardeners. But I really worry about using soap sprays in hot weather. I don't think enough people take the time to rinse the soap off the plants or really understand the fact that you must spray the pest for insecticidal soap to work. I mean, if you just spray the plant when there's no pests on it, all you do is get a nice shiny plant.
No, all I'm doing is spraying actually the eggs and the little flies as they seem to nest, if you will.
I don't know what you would call it. Now, white flies are very distinctive in that when you disturb the plants, a cloud of them will rise into the air.
Exactly.
Okay. Uh-huh. I'll give you all the good news. The good news is that this tends to be a very temporary problem. These pests can't overwinter here in the Northeast. Out on the West Coast or places where they don't get really hard freezes over winter, these pests are awful. These are year-round. But what you have is actually an escaped greenhouse whitefly. Whiteflies are one of the biggest pests of greenhouses. And when people take plants out of greenhouses and take them to gardens, a lot of times, just because they're so pervasive, even a well-managed greenhouse is going to pass along a little whitefly. And it doesn't take long before a little whitefly turns into a lot of whitefly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will tell you one of the best ways to treat them to get started with is to give them a good knockdown just with sharp sprays of water. If you can see egg clusters, to spray them with soap, just blast the rats off. It'll destroy the eggs. It'll destroy the larval forms. The adults.
Harm the plant.
If it's a delicate plant, you want to cradle it with one hand.
Okay.
While you spray them off, and mm-hmm. there are worse activities to do on a hot and sunny day than do something that you know is going to get you soaked with cold water. You know, go out there, in your bathing suit. You should be able to knock down a good 75% to 90% of the white flies. And, of course, by concentrating on the eggs and the immature things, you'll be breaking up the life cycle. And then I want you to go nuts with yellow sticky traps. The color of Rust-Oleum yellow is the color yellow that white flies are attracted to like mad. I'm sure in catalogs and bigger garden centers you've seen these yellow sticky traps sold.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've been through greenhouses, you see these things on stakes around all the plants.
Okay.
The more yellow traps you put in your garden, the more white flies will throw themselves to their death on these traps, which is very emotionally satisfying, by the way. You may find that it is so effective that you'll have to take down your traps because they will become white and non-sticky. They will become covered, literally covered with every white fly you have. Wow. Keep at it. Make sure you're destroying the younger generation. Make sure you capture and kill the adults on these yellow sticky traps. And you may have a couple of white flies hanging around all season long, but maybe 2% of what you got now, and then they will die over winter. They will not overwinter and would need to be reintroduced through other greenhouse plants. If you know, for instance, if you got all your plants from one greenhouse, you may want to go back and ask them about their white fly prevention techniques and ask them to step it up a little bit. But this has happened to me in my current location once in 25 years of gardening. So, the news is all good, and they have a lot of weaknesses. Like Green Lantern's power ring, they are helpless against the color yellow.
Well, thank you very much. That is just a great help. Hopefully, I'm going to kill them all.
Yeah, that's the spirit, Bob. All right, good luck, man.
Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Karen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call, Mr. McGrath.
Why, thank you for making it, Karen. Where are you?
I'm in Chesapeake City, Maryland.
Oh, okay. Now, where in Maryland is that?
That's on the eastern shore of Maryland, on the upper eastern part of the Delmarva Peninsula.
Oh, okay. Sure.
We're about an hour south of Philadelphia.
Oh, okay, so you're very close. You're at the very beginning of the Eastern Shore.
Yes.
Okay, very good. All right, beautiful area there. What can we do you for?
Well, we're having problems with our grapes. We have a grape arbor 100 feet long.
Ooh, nice.
Mostly Concord grapes.
Right.
Two other varieties that I don't know what they are. The grape arbor is about 12 years old, and we've had wonderful response from it up until last year.
Mm-hmm.
Last year and this year, the grapes made up beautifully, and when they start to ripen, they just shrivel up and dry up to nothing.
Well, that doesn't sound good. Now, did you plant this arbor yourself?
Yes.
And so you've been pruning the vines every winter, and you thin the grape clusters throughout the beginning of the season?
Yes. We prune them in February.
Right.
And then when the grape clusters are about an inch long, we prune back the vines.
And you do remove some of the clusters?
No, we haven't.
Ah.
We haven't done that.
That could be one of the issues. Grapes are very similar to apples and peaches in that they traditionally put on more fruit than the plant can handle. And in a stressful year, these have been two stressful years in a row for different reasons.
Yes, they have.
It pays to thin. Now, I'm no expert at growing grapes. My fruits are raspberries and peaches, which are their own problems. But it is my understanding that with very vibrant grapevines, which is very easy, they are very lush plants, that not only should you be removing some of the clusters of grapes when they're small, but some of the leaves as well to ensure good airflow throughout the plant.
Okay.
But you haven't seen any sign of actual disease, right?
No.
That's good.
Now, up until last year, we sprayed them every year with fruit tree spray. This year, we did not.
Now, fruit tree spray means nothing. Do you know what you were spraying them with?
Well, I asked my husband. He said, fruit tree spray.
Yeah,
didn't have a brand name for me.
No, not a brand name, but just, is it an organic? Is it a chemical?
It's a chemical.
Right, and so I presume it was an antifungal.
Yes.
But you never saw signs of fungal disease?
No, we haven't seen any disease.
Well, you don't spray.
Evidence of disease.
I mean, in some cases, like with my peach trees, which are so prone to so many conditions, growers are advised to spray preventively. And I use an antifungal, anti-disease spray that goes by the brand name Serenade, which is very good for grapes, by the way. It's a naturally it's a naturally occurring soil organism known as Bacillus subtilis. And it is just as effective as the chemical disease sprays, but it's all natural and much less harmful to you. What else changed? Did you start feeding it? Did you stop feeding it?
We have never fertilized them, and we don't water them.
Okay. I would have advised watering them during the severe heat wave droughts we had earlier this summer. I was deep watering my peach trees during that. You have to realize that these plants are only human, and as the climate changes, they're being put through inordinate stresses. I would give them a little bit of compost, like an inch of compost around the base of the vines, give them a little bit of natural nutrition, but I would also water them deeply when we go a week without rain and the temperatures are in the 100 degrees. I mean, any plant is going to be stressed during that time.
Okay.
And again, by not thinning the fruit clusters and by not thinning the grape leaves, you're maxing out the stress on the plant. They're trying to keep more parts of the plant alive than they can. By your selective removal, there's less for the plant to do. And if you give it a little bit of help in the form of some natural nutrition and some water during dry times, I think you'll go back to your good harvests again.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. Good luck, Karen. I hope you get grapes next year.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that we have been dragged, kicking and screaming, into the 20th century and are now on Facebook. So you can go there and like us, or I have no idea what the alternative is. Can you dislike us? Well, to paraphrase a popular cutaway on the excellent public radio show American Roots, if you like us, tell everybody. If you don't like us, don't tell nobody. But don't you be telling nobody nothing just yet, because we'll be right back with the news about honeybees, how to keep borers out of your iris, and lots more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that now is the time to start fall crops like broccoli, cabbage, and cauliflower, and to get ready for garlic planting. More information at burpee.com.
Listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Please Touch Museum at Memorial Hall in Fairmount Park, the Children's Museum of Philadelphia, supports WHYY. Please Touch Museum offers two full floors of interactive exhibit space, daily theater shows, musical programming, and a century-old refurbished carousel. Families can enjoy the museum's long-standing mission of learning through play. Please Touch Museum is located off I-76 and features on-site parking. PleaseTouchMuseum.org or 215-581-3181.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, how to prevent those nasty borers from destroying your beautiful iris plants. And, of course, lots of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to bring on our special guest, Dr. Bill Quarles, director of the BIRC, the Biointegral Resource Center in Berkeley, California. He is the editor of two fine journals, Common Sense Pest Control, and the journal we're going to refer to today, the IPM Practitioner, IPM standing for Integrated Pest Management. Bill Quarles, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I am doing very well. How are you, Bill?
Good. It's a beautiful day here.
I received my latest issue of the IPM Practitioner just a few weeks ago, and was struck by your very total coverage of the honeybee crisis. You don't hear a lot of people paying a lot of attention much anymore to the honeybee decline. That seemed to be last year's news, but you got it right front and center here. What prompted you to make it the cover feature?
There's been recently a lot of new research that has been published within really the last couple of months that has sort of focused the issue and provided evidence that pesticides are a major cause of honeybee deaths.
Now, let's just drop back and do a little honeybee primer for the listeners, because a lot of people get confused between the different types of bees and wasps. We have hundreds and hundreds of different types of native bees in the United States. Only the females can sting, and they rarely, if ever, do. We do have stinging wasps that look a lot like bees. Honeybees can sting. Honeybees are the only bees that make appreciable amounts of honey, enough for us to take some of it. But they're not native. They came to America through Europe, originally from Africa. And you have been following the research really carefully on why we're losing so many. How many colonies did you estimate that American beekeepers lose every year?
There's about 30% loss every year now for the last 5 years.
And are these losses, you know, I may be asking you a trick question. I don't know if there's been any research on this. Are these losses worse in any geographic region? Is it almost like plants? Do honeybees have to be grown as an annual in the far north where it gets so cold over winter?
Well, actually, it's all over the place, but a lot of the problem, like you say, is in the areas where it's cold. You have more attrition there because you know, they have to really work to stay warm and to just survive. But also, there are losses even in Florida.
Hmm. One of the things you write about in the article, which I don't remember ever hearing, is that there's two kinds of bees in every hive. There's summer bees and there's winter bees.
Yeah, that's the way it shakes out, is that genetically they're a little bit different or physiologically different, and so that the winter bees live longer. They live like 6 months. These are adult bees we're talking about. Of course, you know, they're immature bees, like eggs and larvae, et cetera. But the adult winter bees live about 6 months, whereas the summer bees, the adults, live about 6 weeks. But they're constantly hatching out, and so you have staggered populations. But basically, the summer bees are physiologically different than the winter bees. The winter bees are actually more susceptible to pesticides than the summer bees are.
Now, that's almost counterintuitive, because the summer bees are out pollinating crops that have not only been sprayed, but as you point out in your article, that have systemic pesticides through every cell in their little plant bodies.
Yeah, that's counterintuitive, but I think the reason that the winter bees are more susceptible to pesticides is that they are fatter and they have the pesticides accumulate in fat.
That's true.
And
yeah.
Also, the cold weather synergizes the effect of the pesticide on the bee. You're right, though. The summer foragers, are a lot of them are killed. That some of them don't live that full 6 weeks. And so when things really get bad, why some of the nurse bees or immatures have to go out and forage, and this also has some effects on colony health.
Right, it's like in the Civil War, you run out of able-bodied men, all of a sudden you got 60-year-old guys and 14-year-olds out there.
That's right.
So we've looked at pesticides in the past. One thing you seem to be emphasizing in this article is the systemic pesticides, which, you know, to put it simply, everybody understands the concept of spraying something on a plant that's poisonous to insects. But in this case, we coerce the plant to take up the poison, and literally every bite of every plant part contains a pesticide, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And this sort of crept up on us, is that, you know, sort of unnoticed, all of a sudden we find that 45% of American crops the total area is systemic.
Really?
Which is a lot.
40% of...
45%.
I didn't realize systemic pesticides had become that widespread.
Yeah, it's because they have been eminently successful. And part of the reason is that organophosphates were regulated, and so they had to find some other solution. And so they started using on corn things like systemic pesticides. This way they don't have to spray organophosphates.
But
so in some ways it's good, in some ways it's bad.
I can say from the point of view of consumers, it's terrible because these are pesticides you can't wash off your produce if you buy conventional produce.
That's true, but it's fortunate to some degree that the residues from a seed treatment, at least in corn, you have a very, very low residues, like parts per billion. So for anybody that's not buying organic produce, they're always going to have a pesticide residue, like you say, with a systemic, you just cannot wash it off.
And is the research showing that the systemics, is there any direct correlation between them and the honeybee declines?
To find a direct cause and effect is very hard. The University of Pennsylvania analyzed hives from 23 states, and they found 121 different pesticides, and this includes systemics, but they had miticides, insecticides, fungicides, and even herbicides, and each sample contained about seven different pesticides. The major problem, I think, is not so much that they're just killed outright, but the sublethal effects. The sublethal effects of the pesticide, it depresses their immune system and makes them more susceptible to diseases. And so this is contributing to it. And so you know, some people say, okay, well, they're all being killed by diseases, but maybe the primary effect is the sublethal pesticides contributing to depressed immune systems, making them more susceptible to disease.
The scariest thing in your article in the latest issue of IPM Practitioner is the headline, Bumblebees Also Affected. I've been watching native bees pollinate my raspberries for the past couple of weeks, and I've really enjoyed watching the bumblebees, which when I was a kid I thought were like a single type of bee. And I must have 5, 6, 7 different sizes and shapes and colors of bumblebees, and maybe 2 dozen other native bees all over my raspberry flowers.
Yeah.
And
well, I love bumblebees too.
And I just can't imagine indiscriminate use of pesticides hurting my native bees.
Yeah, it's the thing is the systemics do not discriminate, and so they have done some experiments with this where they show that bumblebees on treated fields, you have about a 10% attrition. And then one study that was a couple of months ago published showed that if you just fed bumblebees some of these systemic pesticides at levels that they encounter in the field, so that it would be the same as the bumblebee feeding on a treated field, they found that there was about a 10% loss in weight on the colonies, and 85% fewer queens were produced. So in the long run, this could have really profound effects on bumblebees if you don't have as many queens anymore.
If these systemic pesticides can affect our native bees, I mean, Bill, I don't need to tell you the old line, no bees equals no food, right?
That's true. And the problem comes quite often from the seed treatments. The machines that they use to plant the seeds, it blows seed waste into the air, and then this settles onto the ground. And so that's like sort of coating the soil with a fine layer of pesticide. And the problem is that some of these systemics have half-lives of 2 to 3 years, and so it just stays there for a very long time.
So, Bill, let's try to cop some good news before we say goodbye. I have noticed, I have been trying to pay more attention to the native bees in my garden. Every year I see a larger diversity of different species, and I see greater numbers of each different species. And my wife kindly thinks that I've created kind of a refuge for them and for birds by having a nice organic acre that's safe for them to go from flower to flower and lots of places for them to hide and their nests won't be disturbed. Is this an unseen good that organic farmers and gardeners can do? Are we like?
Oh yeah, I think that organic one is that you're not using pesticides, and so even if you're using honeybees, they're not going to be impacted so much. But also, where you don't use pesticides, then that encourages the native bees, and so yeah. I think that one solution to this is to convert more and more to organic agriculture.
All right. Well, you heard it from Dr. Bill Quarles, the director of the BIRC, the Biointegral Resource Center in Berkeley, California. You can find out more about their fine publications at BIRC.org. Bill Quarles, thanks again for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. Bye.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, David. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
I am doing just fine, sir. Where is David pretty good?
Philadelphia, PA.
And so, what part of Philly?
South Philly.
All right. Yo, David.
yep, exactly.
What part of South Philly?
Well, 11th and Washington.
Oh, right. I got you. I got you on my radar. I got you on my GPS.
Just around the Italian Market.
All right. What can we do for David in South Philly?
My girlfriend and I, we have a really tiny area in our backyard. It's all raised beds. And we've tried to really maximize our space. And we have quite a few flowers and also some fruits and vegetables. And our tomato plants are very tall, but they are yielding very little fruit. I think we only have 3 tomatoes so far, and it's only on one plant.
Are you feeding them?
Yes, we are.
What are you feeding them?
Pretty much we have an organic fertilizer that we're using on them. I think it's by the same company that makes Hollytone.
Okay, so that would be Espoma. And would it be plant tone or tomato tone or something like that?
Yeah, it's a plant tone. It's a generalized fertilizer.
Okay, all right. Well, those aren't bad fertilizers. They're close to organic. The nutrient levels aren't, like, out of line. How often are you feeding?
We've only done it once so far this season, but we find that our soil's pretty naturally fertile itself. Whoever was there before put a lot of, I mean, they pretty much put potting soil from the bottom up where the tomatoes are.
Good. So, do they have enough room, David? Are they staked up? Are they inside cages? Does each plant have a 2-foot wide footprint?
We realize they're probably a little tight. Maybe like a foot and a half imprint for each. We have like 3 of them. They're pretty tightly together, but they're all staked, and we have 2 cages, actually, to get them that high.
Okay, good. And so there's airflow between the plants. There's no sign of disease or anything like that.
We're starting to think that maybe that might be the problem. They're in a corner, so there's a wall maybe going up about 4 feet for the plants.
Right.
And our tallest plant is starting to show yellowing at the bottom.
Well, that's probably because you've been growing tomatoes in that same spot year after year.
Okay.
That's your next problem you're going to have to deal with next year, is you have to rotate your tomatoes to different spots in your land, which can be difficult in Center City. If it's just yellowing at the base of the plant and it's going up slowly, just pull off those diseased leaves and don't worry about it too much. The way your tomatoes are growing, they will probably outgrow the problem. But next year, you're going to have to find new places to put them. Don't plant them in the same spot because you have developed a soil-borne wilt in the soil. Very natural. It happens whether you're chemical or organic. How much sun do they get? Do they get an incredible amount of sun or a minimal amount of sun?
They get a pretty good amount of sun.
Hours a day.
Probably about 5 or 6 hours.
Okay, that's about the minimum, man, for fruiting plants.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
You know, leafy greens, potatoes, lettuces, garlic, stuff like that, they can get by with a lot less sun. But when you need flowers and fruits, you really need 6 to 8 hours of sun a day. So they're probably not getting enough sun. And how are you watering them?
We water them every day. I mean, they're
why?
Matter of routine, I guess.
And,
you know.
And how long do you water them?
I guess about maybe a minute.
Okay.
You know,
Yeah, you're totally wrong, and this could be the problem.
Okay.
What I want you to do is, do you have any mulch on top of the soil?
No mulch.
Yeah, see if you can find some old leaves laying around. But from now on, I want you to water by letting a hose drip at the base of the plant in the morning for an hour or two,
okay,
once or twice a week. Your minute watering every day is actually worse for the plant than no water at all.
Okay.
So I want you to think deep watering, infrequent watering. Saturate the soil. Let the plant use up that moisture over a couple of days. Let its roots go dry. And then resaturate the soil. And during a heat wave, like we've gone through a couple times already this summer,
yeah,
when it gets above 95 degrees, tomatoes can't set new fruits.
Okay.
So when the temperature drops down, then they can produce flowers with reliable pollen. So you might also be a victim of the heat wave. But I'll tell you, if you change your watering strategies, you'll increase your odds of success greatly.
All right, sounds good. Thank you so much.
Good luck, man.
All right, thanks.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and thank the Easton Farmers Market for inviting me to be a part of their big 260th birthday celebration earlier this month. And special thanks to the great listeners who came out to hear me talk, despite the 100-degree weather. Except for any Canadians, for them it was only 38. The Easton Market is a local treasure, and farmers markets across the country are a great way to access fresh local food and to support local farm families. But don't go planning to see the face that grew your fennel just yet, because we'll be right back with how to keep borers out of your iris and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that now is the time to start fall crops like broccoli, cabbage, and cauliflower, and to get ready for garlic planting. More information at burpee.com. Penn Medicine supports WHYY. For patients with lung cancer, there is the Abramson Cancer Center at Penn, with treatments like proton therapy that more accurately targets lung cancer tumors. Targeted therapies that attack your tumor's specific genetic makeup, and a team that specializes in treating only lung cancer. Penn's Abramson Cancer Center offers more options to help save your life. More at pennmedicine.org/lungcancer or 800-789-PENN.
Taking a look at the WHYY forecast, not too bad today. We should see some sun this afternoon with a high temperature of about 81. Mostly clear tonight, a low in the mid-60s. Tomorrow's sunshine and a high of 85. And looking ahead to Monday, thunderstorms Monday, the high 84. Right now it's 72 degrees.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, it'll be time for the question of the week. How to keep those nasty, hungry, hungry caterpillars known as the iris borers out of the rhizomes of those beautiful and dramatic plants. You won't want to miss it, and you won't. Just sit through a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Michael, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you?
I am doing well today. Michael, how are you, sir?
I am great.
And where is Michael great?
I am great in Cary, North Carolina.
Everybody we talk to in the Carolinas is just so, I'm going to come down and slap you people silly. You need to, you have too nice a climate, you know.
Yeah, well, today could be better.
Put you in a good mood. What can we do for Michael down in the Carolinas?
Yes, sir. I have an issue with my backyard.
Mm-hmm.
My backyard is really shaded. Very, very little to almost no sun gets to the ground. My wife and I are currently in the process of trying to make it a nicer place for the kids to play.
Mm-hmm.
We had a vine. I'm not entirely sure what it is, but it could probably give kudzu a run for its money. we tore it up, and now we're down to bare dirt, like the red clay dirt mix. And we're trying to figure out a nice grass that we can put in there that will grow well without coming out like a patchy or balding in spots.
Yeah.
Okay. In that dirt with almost no sun.
Well, you're going to soil you can improve.
Right.
Is the lack of sun caused by trees?
Yes.
You're in a world. You're in a world of trouble.
Yeah.
Does the area get at least 4 hours of sun a day?
One section, it's probably 3 or 4 feet wide, could probably get maybe 30 minutes of sun.
Well, then grass will not grow there.
Okay.
The minimum for even a shade-loving grass, which does not tolerate a lot of foot traffic, is 4 hours a day. And okay. When people have big trees, which are a mitzvah where you are in the summertime, the shade trees, they always think about the shade being the reason they can't grow good grass. But actually, a lot of times it is the bullying of the tree's root system, taking okay. all the moisture and nutrients. If you can imagine, because I'm guessing you have pretty massive trees.
Yes.
Imagine the complexity of that root system. And here you are, l'enfant grass, trying to, please, sir, can I have a little bit to eat or drink? Right. And the answer is going to be no. Away with okay. you, boy. So you're going to be looking for a solution out there that is not grass. And because you want kids to play on it, it probably, and in your heat, probably moss would be difficult to maintain, although you have pretty acid soil down there, and you have okay. a lot of shade. One bizarre suggestion would be a moss lawn, but you would have
lawn?
A moss, M-O-S-S.
Okay.
Moss is green all year long, never needs right. to be fed, never needs to be cut, and there are companies now that supply moss in, like, sod form. And
okay.
in dry mixes that you regenerate. And some of these can take a fair amount of foot traffic. How many kids you got?
Two.
How old?
2 and 4.
Oh, man, they're going to tear it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think what you want to do is you want to contact your local state extension office. Because okay. you're in a unique kind of climate, I'm going to suggest you ask them about the best ground covers for
okay.
your area. There are some sedums. There are some low-growing ground covers that are often sold under branded names like Steppables.
Okay.
A lot of times they're sold to deliberately put between pavings, pavers, to kind of take up the space so weeds can't move in.
Okay.
But you can make a nice alternative lawn out of some of these low-growing ground covers. There's always going to be some give and take, and
okay.
we have to think about your summertime heat more than your wintertime cold. So that's where your state extension service can give you a short list and tell you this one is guaranteed to survive summer. It might feel a little prickly. We think this is the best one. It's going to feel like you're walking on a lawn, and it's going to
okay.
do well in the heat as long as you keep it watered. But they'll have a short list, and that's what you want, is alternative ground covers that can take shade and foot traffic. And there
okay.
should be two or three that'll work in your environment.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it.
All right, man. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Sheila, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Sheila. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. I'm a little perplexed. How are you?
Well, I'm always perplexed, so you've already confused me here. Where is Sheila great but perplexed?
We are in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Just across the bridge from Philadelphia.
That's right.
All right. What can we do for perplexed but great Sheila?
Well, I have a wonderful rosemary bush that started as a little tiny herb pot that I brought in the summer so that I could cook with it along with some parsley and basil. And then it grew, and instead of dying off like everything else and like it does every year, it didn't die. So we brought it in and put it into our little greenhouse. It's like a bump out from the living room.
Oh, okay.
And which is great. It has southern exposure, and it grew.
Mm-hmm.
And it grew. And then we put it out in the summer. Now it's 5 years old, and it's huge. And I can't use that much rosemary, but it's gorgeous.
Right.
But it's getting too big for the greenhouse. And I can't leave it outside on the deck. So can I plant it in the ground in Cherry Hill?
You are right on the cusp. Mm. If you had done this last season, for instance, mm-hmm. you would have gotten away with murder because we didn't get winter.
Right.
If we get a normal winter, the odds are that the rosemary would not survive.
Mm.
In, for instance, should you go across the Ben Franklin Bridge mm-hmm. and go to Center City, Philadelphia, and plant your rosemary in the center of the city in one of the many community gardens,
mm-hmm.
it would thrive. It would turn into a tree.
It looks like it, yes.
But when you get out to the suburbs, when you lose that heat sink of the city, everything is about microclimate and exposure. You're down in Virginia Beach, it's a year-round plant outside. You're down in maybe even Ocean City, Maryland, in a protected area. You're probably really safe. Obviously, New York State, it's dead by December. So, I mean, it sounds like this plant is so remarkable. And you have perfected the hard art, although you perfected it because you didn't know it was hard, of keeping it alive indoors over winter.
I don't know what we did.
Well, I can tell you two things you did.
What?
One, that kind of conservatory window
mm-hmm.
is the perfect situation for a plant like this. I would also say that either your house is dry over the winter, you have it in a clay pot, and or you have a very light hand with water.
Well, how about 2 out of 3?
I'll take 2 out of 3 any day. That's a 667 batting average. You know?
It's in a clay pot. The house is dry, but we do keep moist air vaporizers going throughout the house, and we also, I think, we water it a lot.
Okay. Well, the reason I say that is rosemary hates being waterlogged.
Oh.
Rosemary is one of these Mediterranean plants like lavender. Rosemary can be killed by outdoor cold. It's a very Mediterranean plant. It's very frost sensitive. But I've also been told that in many iffy areas, rosemary that died over winter probably died more from waterlogged soil than it did from air temperature cold. So having it in a clay pot, the reason you have to water all the time is that clay pot doesn't hold water.
Mm-hmm.
It wicks it right back out into the atmosphere of your dry house,
mm-hmm.
which is absolutely perfect. It means your rosemary is getting a lot of moisture, but its roots are never sitting in water. So you've accidentally stumbled upon the perfect situation. And I am going to suggest a unique solution to your non-problem. Whatever kind of holidays you celebrate, it is the perfect time to give people gifts of rosemary.
Oh.
Rosemary is truly the herb of remembrance. Sage does not make you sage, but rosemary does.
Mm.
In medical study after medical study, just inhaling the aroma, just rubbing rosemary and inhaling that fabulous fragrance, increases your mental alertness, is good for your brain, delays dementia. Many long-haul truck drivers either take live rosemary with them in the cab, or they have atomizers that spray the essence of rosemary to keep them awake and alert during long drives. Rosemary is not only to be used for cooking, it has many other uses. And in my experience, because I grow a lot of garlic and I make my own garlic powder and I give that to special friends at Christmas, they would rather get that than a $100 gift certificate. And to get your organically homegrown rosemary wrapped up in a little ribbon or with some raffia, I mean, it makes a great gift.
That's a great idea.
And that way you can keep the size of the plant under control, and you've kept this thing alive now for 5 years. honey, don't change a thing.
Where do I trim it from when I start giving it away? Bottom or the top?
Whatever you want to do, really, as long as you don't remove more than one-third of the plant in any given season. This is a plant that likes to be harvested.
Great. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Sheila. Excellent. Good luck.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. You too.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. The nasty caterpillar borers who are the worst enemy of iris. Reading this week's question is our production assistant, Kelly Haggerty. Kelly, take it away with this week's question.
Thanks, Mike. Gail in Buckingham, Pennsylvania writes, I have written you before with much success and am hoping you can help me this time. I have iris plants all throughout my gardens, in front and back. I thought that this spring's wet weather was to blame for the buds not opening on some, as the stalks looked brown and very wet. I have since come to discover that these plants are, quote, infected with what appears to be an iris borer worm. The Ortho Problem Solver book helped me identify it, but now I don't know what to do because I refuse to use the chemicals they recommend.
And thank you for making that decision, Gail.
Any suggestions you can provide would be much appreciated. Thank you in advance from a broken-hearted iris lover. P.S. There is a wonderful lady near Upper Black Eddy, Pennsylvania, who has the most lovely and huge iris garden. When it blooms, she sends a note card to those who have signed up, and you can visit, pick out the irises you love, and she will graciously dig some up, for a price, of course. The flowers are perfect, and she happily shares her growing knowledge. I haven't been there for a few years, but with this problem, I think I'll have to visit her next year. I believe the name is River Valley Iris Garden. Oh, and here's a photo of some of my beauties, now gone, but not forgotten. Thank you for all of your help.
Well, thank you for your kind words and the fabulous photo of that beautiful iris variety. We'll post it at our website and with this question of the week. Now, we were able to follow your clues and verify that the name of the place is indeed River Valley Iris Farm, and its owner, Helen Lewis, is still offering her treasures to the public, although this year's blooming season is over. We'll answer your question now as best we can, but we should also point out that masterful caretakers like Helen are probably the best source of iris advice. And people like you, who already have a relationship with such talented growers, should try and utilize their knowledge as well. Now, the life cycle of this pest allows a lot of opportunities to thwart it. The, quote, borer worm that tunnels into these pretty flowers is a caterpillar, whose eggs will be laid by a night-flying moth late this August or early September. Protecting the plants with floating row covers during that stretch will physically prevent the laying of next year's eggs, and seems to me to be the best possible response to this problem. I would also strongly advise not leaving outdoor lights on overnight. They can attract these and similar pests to their prey. The eggs laid this fall will not hatch until next spring, so promptly removing all the dead leaves and other iris trash in late August should dispose of any already laid eggs and give new moths fewer places to attack. Or just lift your iris rhizomes out of the soil in early August, store them inside, and replant them after Halloween. If no protective tricks are employed, the caterpillars will hatch out in the spring and can be observed crawling on the plant for a week or so before they start to tunnel into the leaves. Here's another opportunity to stop them before they can damage the plants. Beginning in April and continuing through May, spray the plants with the organic caterpillar killer BT, specifically the BTK strain of BT, available under brand names like Dipel, Thoracide, and Greenstep. Non-toxic to everything else, BT, a naturally occurring soil organism, only kills caterpillars, and it only kills caterpillars that chew on the sprayed leaves. This will stop the pests at their first bite without harming you or anything else. Now, you miss that opportunity and things get ugly fast. Undeterred caterpillars then enter the leaves, creating feeding channels that look a lot like leaf miner damage, and that, yes, make the leaves of the iris look wet. This is pretty much your last chance. Prune off all the affected leaves and throw them in the trash. Your iris might not bloom that year, but it also might not die, which is a pretty fair trade. Miss that chance, and the borers move down into the rhizome, the big fleshy root of the iris plant, and quickly grow fat as they chew into it. So if you see plants that look wet and are beginning to wilt, pull them out of the soil and look for the borer holes. If the pests have not yet moved into the rhizome, rip off and trash all those infested leaves. If you do see their entrance holes, shoot beneficial nematodes into the holes with a garden syringe. The microscopic predators will consume the caterpillars inside, or just stick a thin wire into the holes to kill the caterpillars. Granted, the rhizomes may be toast by then, but at least you'll get even. Well, that sure was a lot of good information about deflecting the borers of iris now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition with that promised photo of some amazing iris, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to expose my rhizomes to hungry, hungry caterpillars if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check voice to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. We click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. You Bet Your Garden is now on Facebook. Please visit our page and tell us what you think. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin, don't call me Merv Griffin. Our webmaster is Baneful Rich Banowitz. His faithful internet companion is Sarah Kazar. You Bet Your Garden's internet family pet is Zabu. Down, boy. Rhizomatous Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Spring Blooming Kelly Haggerty is our production assistant. Unbearded Al Banks is our esteemed editor. I'm Night Flying Mike McGrath, and I'll swing around that porch light and see you again next week. Although you can use it to scrub pots and pans, few gardeners sing the praises of the weed known as horsetail. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a close look at this unusual plant. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Magnolia, maple, maybe mountain laurel. Mike helps us master what matters for a magnificent garden on You Bet Your Garden every Saturday morning at 11 here on WHYY.